Hello, I'm Lina Khmudu. Welcome to Health Chat. The U.S. ended a 10-day pause on the use of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine. The move came after reports of blood clots were linked to the vaccine, leading to a pause in the U.S. and other countries. South Africa announced it will resume its vaccination rollout with the Johnson & Johnson shot, following a temporary suspension for the same reasons. Blood clots were also reported with some patients who were inoculated with the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine. For more on the subject and the blood clots and its significance with regards to safety of COVID-19 vaccine, I spoke with Dr. Jonathan Bakhtari, pulmonary and critical care expert and CEO of e7health.com and U.S. Drug Test Center. Take a listen.
Dr. Bakhtari, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
A lot has been going on the COVID-19 vaccine front. Several vaccines have been developed and are being administered around the world. But there have been some recent developments in terms of side effects. One such side effect is blood clots. It started with AstraZeneca vaccine that some people were developing side effects. Now, recently, Johnson & Johnson also made the announcement that there were some side effects associated with the vaccine that were related to blood clots. First of all, what is your reaction to all these developments that we are seeing with regards to blood clots that are associated with COVID-19 vaccines?
Yeah, well, the blood clots seem so far to be confined to the class of vaccines that use cold viruses as the vector, meaning the AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson. Certainly in the case of Johnson & Johnson, the incidence is very, very low. You know, we've given out 7 million doses and we've had 6 reports of clots. And these clots are very special clots. They happen, for example, in the blood vessels, the veins draining the brain. And those are very unusual blood clots. But nonetheless, there's 6 cases reported so far out of 7 million. And just to put it in perspective, if you get COVID, you know, your chances are tenfold to get the same kind of clots or worse. So the chances are still minimal, and on balance, the benefits outweigh the risk.
You just said something. If you get COVID, your chances of getting this kind of blood clots are tenfold. Can you elaborate just a little more, please?
Yeah, it's unclear, you know, fivefold, 20-fold, but it's significantly more. And so, you know, it's not like if you get COVID, you're not at risk with exactly the same blood clot. And so, you know, if you assume, you know, a third of all Americans have gotten COVID, you know, one third documented and two thirds not, then, you know, more than likely, if you don't get the vaccine, there's a high likelihood you're going to wind up catching COVID anyway. So it's not like you're going to escape this risk of getting blood clots, whether you get COVID or you get the vaccine. Certainly, it's a lot less if you get the vaccine. But nonetheless, my suspicion is later this week, the announcement will come out and they'll restrict it to the probably age groups or keep it from the age groups that are more at risk to get these side effects.
So do we know why the blood clots are happening? You mentioned that there are a possibility when one has COVID-19, but when it comes to the vaccine, do we know at all?
Yeah, we have some preliminary data. There is a phenomenon where antibodies are created often. And in this case, we think there are some antibodies that are created that attack platelets, which are clotting, you know, little molecules in your blood, and activate them to cause clots. We see the same thing with drug-induced similar clots, like heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, which is a specific clotting disorder that when we give a certain drug, it does the same thing. We speculate the same thing's happening when you get these vector-related vaccines that were triggering possible antibodies towards the platelets, which then activate the platelets in your blood and cause clotting.
When we look at the side effect with AstraZeneca and blood clot being one of them in some patients, not everyone, and Johnson & Johnson as well, what does it tell us in terms of the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines? Is it something that we should look forward to, or perhaps it will develop, or is the science behind the vaccines different where there is less likely the possibility of blood clots developing?
Yeah, I mean, so far, there is no peer-reviewed data that we're seeing blood clots with Moderna and Pfizer. But of course, the ultimate irony is this was the technology everybody was afraid of when the vaccines were being rolled out. Now they're viewed as maybe the safer one. But yeah, we don't have any peer-reviewed data that we're seeing blood clots because it's a different mechanism.
The mRNA approach.
Yeah, the mRNA vaccine sends the genetic material in what is essentially a soap bubble or a lipid particle. The vector vaccines put the genetic material in a cold virus and inject the cold virus into you. So the mechanism is different. And so it's a little bit ironic that people rightfully or wrongfully think that mRNA vaccines are now the safer vaccine, but all three are very safe, actually.
Who is more at risk of developing side effects and blood clot in particular when it comes to this vaccine?
Well, I mean, women are, the six people that got it were women between the ages of 18 and 48, and no men in this case. So, but women in general are at high risk for many sort of autoimmune diseases that cause blood clots in general. And just to be, you know, just put everything in perspective, you know, getting pregnant puts you at risk for blood clots. Using birth control puts you at risk of blood clots for women. And probably at a higher rate than taking the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. You know, we don't tell women not to get pregnant or use birth control. So it really puts it in perspective when you look at the incidence per 100,000 of blood clots in Johnson & Johnson versus getting pregnant versus being on birth control.
So when people take the vaccine, how do they know that the side effects they have are normal versus something to be concerned with, perhaps a blood clot? Also identifying in a case of a blood clot.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, a couple of things. First of all, the time frame for these six patients were between 6 and 13 days after getting the vaccine. So if it's the day or two after the vaccine, or if you're more than 2 weeks out, you probably have very little to be concerned about, even if you're experiencing some side effects. But the side effects from the blood clots in the brain are, you know, signs of what appears to be a stroke, where you get weakness on one side, seizures, change in vision, severe headaches that don't go away. If you're having those symptoms 6 to 13 days after the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, that's when you should seek medical attention.
So how does a blood clot manifest? What are the first signs?
Well, it depends where it is. So we know with the AstraZeneca, there were blood clots in the brain, there's blood clots in the lung, there's blood clots in the abdomen. So, you know, the ones that are in the brain, I sort of describe those symptoms. The ones in the lung, you'll get short of breath and breathing problems. The ones in the abdomen, yeah, it can be severe abdominal pain and crampiness and other signs of intestinal issues. So I think those are all different side effects depending on where the clot is.
There are still people that are skeptical. I mean, many, as a matter of fact. What do you have to say to those people to protect themselves and others?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what I would say is if you're skeptical about getting the vaccine, you better be darn sure you're not going to get COVID, because the risk of getting it on all measures is higher than getting the vaccine based on, you know, everything we know. I think people who don't get the vaccine are just assuming they're not going to be exposed to the virus. And statistically, that may not be a good choice.
One of the concerns that people were having, some of the skeptics, or even though some people who took the vaccine, was the fact that there's no clear answer in terms of if the vaccine completely protects people from catching COVID. So why do people get the vaccine? What are the benefits of the vaccine at this point? What do we know?
Well, it's interesting. The three vaccines, COVID-19 vaccines that have been approved in the United States, the one clear protection is death. Clearly, if you get any one of those three, you know, you're pretty much 99 to 100% protected from dying from COVID. And if you use that as the final yardstick, they're all three extremely effective. Yes, you know, Johnson & Johnson, you know, you still could potentially, you know, catch a milder case for it. But if what you're really concerned is not dying or, you know, being severely ill in a hospital, I think all three are virtually 99% effective in that regard.
So what can you tell us in terms of the turnaround for people coming to your clinic and asking for COVID vaccine? Do you see a lot of interest? Also, are people concerned? What kind of questions do they raise?
Yeah, I think the awareness of infectious viruses and diseases that you can get is much more aware. There was a time where, for example, when people were traveling to certain parts of the world, you know, they would just say, oh, I just will just drink bottled water and be safe. I think now there's an awareness of, you know, things like typhoid, malaria, yellow fever, Japanese encephalitis virus, all of these diseases that we have good vaccines for, and we have prescriptions for malaria. And so people are much more attuned, and we're getting a much more robust response for people to prepare themselves if they're going to put themselves in certain situations.
And just a final question. Do you see a time, perhaps in the future, where COVID vaccine may be mandatory, like yellow fever, when you travel overseas or even nationally?
Well, people always talk about, you know, this vaccine passport. But on some level, it already exists. You know, there's dozens of countries that if you want to enter, you have to present your yellow fever card and prove that you've gotten your yellow fever vaccine. So this will not be like a new thing if it happens, and it probably will, where you have to present proof. As a matter of fact, right now, a lot of countries are requiring you prove that you had a negative test. So it's not a far leap to think that instead of the negative test, they're going to just have you upload your documentation that you've been vaccinated. In fact, I just saw on Hawaii's website that they're, instead of making it mandatory to prove your test, they're thinking about coming out where you just prove that you got the vaccine. So I see that definitely in the cards in the future.
So what is the takeaway from this? We see people that are skeptical. We see more vaccines that are coming out. And we also hear about side effects, blood clots in particular, or that people are very concerned about. So what is the takeaway message here?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the people who are skeptical, this is going to, you know, potentially add fuel to the fire and you know, make them more skeptical. But on balance, you know, you just have to look at the risk of, you know, COVID, if you catch it or if you spread it, versus a potential side effects. I know, for example, antibiotics have side effects, but I know very few people who say, I'm never taking an antibiotic because I could have a really bad reaction. So I think if you view it in terms of getting general anesthesia, going on birth control, you know, those are all risks that we take because we think on balance, the benefit outweigh the risk.
Okay, Dr. Bakhtiari, we appreciate your time and clarification on this subject. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Jonathan Bakhtiari, pulmonary and critical care expert and CEO of e7health.com and U.S. Drug Test Center. It is time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Health Chat. As mentioned earlier, South Africa will resume its COVID-19 vaccination program on Wednesday after it was suspended over reports from America and elsewhere that some people had developed a rare type of blood clots following Johnson & Johnson injections. That vaccine has been the only one available in South Africa, and experts have warned that delays in getting jabs in people's arms are putting their lives at risk. Tuso Khumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Health Minister Zweli Mkhize told the media that the South African Health Product Regulatory Authority has cleared the Johnson & Johnson vaccine as safe enough. He said research revealed that amongst close to 300,000 South Africans who have been vaccinated so far, not one developed the type of blood clot seen in 8 people in the U.S.
The clotting disorder has been identified about 1 in a million kind of people. And then for that reason, therefore itself, that the risk is much, much lower than the benefit of having to use the vaccine.
The green light, however, comes with conditions. The health department is expected to strengthen screening and monitoring of patients at risk of blood clotting. There should be a safe management plan for those who develop vaccine-induced side effects. Consent information sheet should also include a clause alerting participants that there could be a risk of blood clotting. Pregnant and lactating women will not be vaccinated with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine pending further research. Experts are urging the government to speed up the rollout. Health expert Alex van den Heever says if a new violent variant hits the country or a third wave develops, the consequences could be dire.
We should be getting to a point where we vaccinated about 300,000 a day. So even to this point, we haven't registered a little more than what would be a day and a half's worth of vaccinations. So we're nowhere close to scale. We're also going to hit quite a lot of hitches in that a lot of people might not register.
Fundile Nyati from Proactive Health Solutions says, though the government could do things better, some of the causes of the slow vaccine rollout are beyond its control.
The issue of securing vaccine supplies for the country has been the biggest, you know, issue, because developed countries with more money have made sure that they are the first on the line, and they have used what we call vaccine nationalism.
Despite the delays caused by the temporary suspension, the government says it is still on course to finish vaccinating all health workers by the 15th of May and starting inoculation of over 5 million senior citizens above 60 and people with pre-existing conditions. So far, over 1.5 million people have been infected with the coronavirus, with more than 53,000 deaths. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The World Health Organization called for action to build and continue the work to create a malaria-free world as it marked this year's World Malaria Day on April 25th. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Despite the COVID-19 pandemic and multiple other crises, 24 countries are reported to have stopped malaria transmission for three or more years by the end of 2020. To date, 38 countries and territories have been certified malaria-free by the World Health Organization, including most recently El Salvador, Algeria, and Sri Lanka. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says malaria elimination is a viable goal for all countries, no matter how far they may be from the ultimate target.
WHO has identified a set of 25 countries with the potential to reach zero malaria within the next 5 years. Working together, building on each other's success, and supported with sustained funding, we can dare to dream of a malaria-free world.
Malaria is a preventable, treatable disease, yet every year it kills more than 400,000 people, most of them young children in sub-Saharan Africa. Additionally, more than 200 million people become newly infected with this deadly parasitic disease every year. Over the last 20 years, WHO reports more than 7.5 million deaths and 1.5 billion cases have been averted, most in sub-Saharan Africa. Despite this remarkable progress, director of WHO's Global Malaria Program, Pedro Alonso, says most cases and deaths continue to take place in Africa.
While Africa is the source of many of the big success stories in terms of impact, it is also the place where that carries the brunt of the disease and where we are finding it hard to make further progress. Nigeria and DRC, because they're also very large populations, account for nearly 50% of all the global burden of disease.
WHO says political commitment is crucial to ending malaria. The UN Health Agency says most countries that have reached zero malaria have strong primary health care systems that ensure access to malaria prevention, diagnosis, and treatment. WHO estimates up to $4.5 billion a year will be required to stamp out malaria. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new malaria vaccine produced by Oxford University has shown a preliminary efficacy rate of 77% and could help prevent over 400,000 deaths a year, many in sub-Saharan Africa. Henry Wilkins looks at the burden of malaria on families in the region and the potential impact of the new vaccine in this report from Kaya, Burkina Faso.
Pella Sawadogo fled to Gaji village 2 years ago when insurgents attacked, killing her neighbors and brother-in-law. She thought she'd escaped certain death, but last week one of her daughters, Marie, was diagnosed with malaria.
She got some more medicine and we were told to go back home. That was the last prescription she got before passing away at home on Sunday. It affected me a lot. I can't sleep at night. I can't eat.
More than 400,000 people die every year from the mosquito-borne disease, most within sub-Saharan Africa and mostly children under 5 years old. But there is hope. In an exclusive interview with VOA, the director of Oxford University's Jenner Institute says their new malaria vaccine, tested in Burkina Faso, is showing game-changing results.
So what's so exciting about this result is that 140 malaria vaccine candidates have been tried in clinical trials over the years, and none of them has come up with an efficacy over 75%. That's what the WHO, the World Health Organization, is looking for to be really useful in controlling malaria in Africa. In our first attempt with this vaccine, we see 77%, and we think we can improve on that further. So it's real progress. It's unprecedented.
The Jenner Institute says the cost of the new vaccine is expected to be very low and believes widespread use would prevent hundreds of thousands of deaths in Africa each year. While testing is not yet complete, the initial results are also raising hopes with medical aid groups like Doctors Without Borders, MSF.
If the modalities, the characteristics, would make it well feasible to roll out in Africa, that could indeed be a game changer.
The malaria vaccine is entering the third phase of trials in Burkina Faso, Kenya, Mali and Tanzania, and could be widely available in as little as 2 years. But the Jenner Institute, which developed the AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine, is talking to regulators to see if this vaccine can also be fast-tracked for quicker use.
We're making the point that more people died of malaria in Africa last year by a factor of maybe four than died of COVID. So why isn't malaria a priority?
The malaria vaccine will come too late to save the millions who have died over the years, including Sawadogo's daughter Marie. But perhaps by the time Pauline is old enough to understand what happened to her twin sister, malaria deaths could be a rarity in Africa instead of a day-to-day reality. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Kaya, Burkina Faso.
According to Save the Children, more than 1.5 million children under five in Burkina Faso are facing malnutrition. Violence in the country has displaced hundreds of thousands of people, worsening the plight of children. The eastern and central northern regions of Burkina are among the worst affected, as 670,000 children and their families have had to flee their homes. Mavis Okere in Chuaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana has more.
Hubert Wetrago, Children's Communication and Advocacy Director for Save the Children, says the situation was already there as the number of malnourished children has increased. He says more funding needs to be invested to alleviate malnutrition, to implement programs and policies that will have more impact on children. The World Food Programme says nearly 18 million people are facing insufficient food consumption in Burkina Faso, and nearly half of these are children. Wetrago says the violence in the country is worsening their plight. He says more than 1 million people have been forced to flee their villages and homes. And what is alarming is that over 61% of these are children.
Since the beginning of the conflict in some areas, children's rights are in danger of being rolled back. For example, in terms of protection, children are no longer in safe environments when they are forced to flee with their parents. Specifically, their right to education is jeopardized.
He says currently more than 2,200 schools have been closed, affecting more than 300,000 children. Mutrago says the insecurity in rural areas means that many families cannot work in their fields or keep their animals because they fear being attacked or recruited by armed groups. He says many adolescents and men cannot work if that involves traveling beyond their communities, and this has left many households reliant on humanitarian support.
Over the past year, Save the Children has been able to provide support to more than 170,000 children, including those living in displacement camps. Among the children, some were already malnourished, and to address this, Save the Children, for example, put in place what we call babies-friendly spaces where mothers received advices and support to care their babies.
He says only about $3 million out of just $46 million needed for nutrition-related issues have been secured, leaving a huge funding gap. Retrago says 3.5 million people are in need of urgent humanitarian assistance this year.
Save the Children is calling on the government and the international community to continue to put all the effort to urgently respond to the situation in Burkina Faso to save a generation of children at risk. Specifically, Save the Children is asking to prioritize the specific nutritional needs of children in humanitarian response so that no child under 5 dies of preventable causes. This includes providing sufficient funds toward nutrition.
Hubert Wetragu says improved nutrition services, including measures to prevent hunger and malnutrition, are urgently needed to assist children in hard-to-reach areas. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Oshry in Jaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
Senegal banned single-use plastics a year ago, but the regulation has been poorly enforced and plastic waste still litters the coastline and threatens health. For Earth Day this year, a group of Senegalese surfers, scuba divers and activists took matters into their own hands and to set an example for others to follow. Anika Hammerschlag reports from Dakar.
From bottles to bags to food wrappers and fishing nets, plastic waste is piling up on Senegal's beaches, harming the environment that people and animals depend on. Toxic chemicals from plastic leach into the water and can build up in fish, which are a vital part of the Senegalese diet. Senegal's Ministry of Public Health notes links between plastic pollution and infertility, heart disease, cancer, and other health problems.
All of these products that are used by the industry can be dangerous. And in terms of pollution, they can attack all of our organs, but equally those of animals. But especially as you have seen in all these documentaries and studies, it impacts marine life.
The Senegalese government passed a law in 2015 banning single-use plastics, but little changed. The law was rescinded to make way for new legislation that specifically targeted plastic cups, straws, plates, bags, and bottles. It went into effect in 2020, but it's still rarely enforced.
There is not necessarily enough information. The population, the users, are not well enough informed about the existence of this law and its different statutes.
To mark the anniversary of last year's ban and this year's Earth Day, Dakar's Barracuda Scuba Diving Club and activists held a coastal cleanup. Clean Senegal's Khadim Diouf wore a plastic costume while sorting the waste to underscore the need to make an impact.
I think we can do it, us, the citizens of the world. I don't just mean the citizens of Senegal, but the citizens of the world. Everyone must protect their environment. That's what we must do.
Until then, Diouf and other activists say they will continue to campaign for a cleaner Senegal. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar, Senegal.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Check us out at facebook.com/voahealthchat and let's keep the conversation going. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lino Ahmadou in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and wash your hands more frequently, and strive to make every day a healthy day.